Hello, sex nerds, friends. This episode of Sex Nerd Sandra is sponsored by AdamandEve.com. And guess what? They're offering such a great deal, it's kind of ridiculous. Super important, though, is remember to type in sex nerd at checkout and score 4 awesome goodies. 50% off almost any item, free shipping, 3 free DVDs, and an extra spicy super secret gift. Ooh, who knows? It's a mystery. Their selection goes beyond just vibrators, too. I've been perusing, and I'm seeing all kinds of awesome bedroom helpers like liberator pillows, safe and easy beginner bondage kits, cock rings, and even a whole section just on nipple clamps and toys. What? Nipple toys? A category? That's right. At AdamandEve.com. So go there and type in sex nerd at checkout to get 4 awesome bonuses. 50% off almost any item, free shipping, 3 free DVDs, and a super secret gift. AdamandEve.com. You're fun.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra Podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Hello, sex nerds. I've got a few dates for you. Actually, October 11th, Thursday next week is a crazy day for the sex nerd. That's me. I mean, you're a sex nerd too. I mean, come on. We're all sex nerds. If you want to be. But I will be up at UC Santa Barbara all day with a company called Love Campus, talking about oral sex at 11 a.m. and sex toys at 1:30 p.m. So if you're in the Santa Barbara area and a student there, keep an eye out for flyers because I will be around there and you can just hop on in and giggle with me and we can chat. The cool thing is that then I get back to town and at 9 p.m. at Meltdown that night, I'm doing a little crowdsourcing nerdy show called Sex Nerds Unite. And this is the answer I have to me just wanting to bring more fun back into my own life. And that's going to be at Meltdown, and we're going to have prizes. The Pleasure Chest just signed on to give out some prizes. And we're just going to have a good time. So you're going to help me answer emails from people. I may film it for a few clips on YouTube. And if you have coaching questions and you want to just bring them to the show, please do. It's bring a friend for free, too. So if you buy a ticket, bring a friend for free. It'll be awesome. That's going on. And then Dave, I believe, is in San Francisco that night. So check that out, too. Anyway, sex nerds, come on out. I miss you. Okay, now that we've gotten the intro out of the way, thank you. Thank you so much. Last week, I requested that folks send me their stories of how the podcast and info on the podcast has helped your relationships, your sex life, how to get to know yourself better, how it's changed a friend's life. And I have been laughing and tearing up at lots of wonderful stories that have come my way. And I do want to integrate them into my website and just share how a simple free podcast at Nerdist.com and iTunes can be so meaningful to so many people. So please keep sending them. Just subject line story so that I can gather you all into a space and we can all giggle together. No, really, there's some hilarious stuff. Dave is not here this episode, but I have a very sassy attorney here who's extra sassy. Don't look at me like that. So please, we will all miss him, but he will be back next week, I swear. And also, I know we've been pretty heavy lately in terms of, politics and, science and things. I mean, we all love this stuff, but I am planning some pretty juicy pleasure-based episodes coming up. So please stay tuned because the coming weeks are going to be extra hot. And yeah, I can't wait.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Alan, I bet you're going to listen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I can tell you're a naughty monkey.
I respectfully refuse to answer on the grounds that I may incriminate myself.
Oh, good answer. Anyway, I have attorney at law. Is that an official phrase that you say? Attorney at law.
It is.
Alan Gelbard, here at the table because you presented recently at Catalyst Con.
I did.
With Constance Penley.
Constance Penley.
And John Stagliano.
Correct.
Around porn versus the U.S., basically.
It was actually the United States versus John Stagliano. John is the owner of a very large adult entertainment company called Evil Angel. And the Bush administration had a hard-on, shall we say, for adult entertainment. They owed a debt to their conservative base and went after increasingly more mainstream. They started out with some pretty crazy stuff, but they got more and more mainstream. Mm-hmm. And John was the last company that they went after. They indicted him in the District of Columbia on 7 counts of trafficking obscene materials. And we were fortunate to win that case back in, I think it was 2010. It's all kind of a blur now.
Okay. Before we started recording, we were kind of getting on the same page about all the laws, because you'd mentioned there's lots of intense legal laws that don't quite make sense.
Yeah.
When you...
The law is sort of constantly in flux, and especially when you're talking about laws that involve sex and technology, because mm-hmm. society is changing fast and technology is changing fast, the mm-hmm. law tends to be 10 to 15 years behind. Mm-hmm. So, for example, right now everybody's talking about how copyright works with music and things being online, and it's we're getting a different perspective on how that really works. The law of obscenity, which is we call unprotected speech, what I like to call anything that's really, really, really dirty. the government in some situations still tries to prosecute that in the more conservative jurisdictions. And because those laws started developing in the 1950s, and the last real pronouncement from the Supreme Court was 1973, we're way behind. Mm-hmm. Obscenity laws are based on community standards. And, in the 70s, at least, you could arguably say that people would have kind of a rough idea what was available in their jurisdiction. But today they have no idea. You don't know what your next door neighbor's watching. Mm-hmm. So the internet has really changed the lay of the land, so to speak. And, because of that, the laws are now kind of way behind and out of date.
Okay. So previously, when it was just like, maybe a poster on the wall or a song on the radio, it was easier to kind of get together with your neighbors and be like, do we want this? Is this obscene? Are we okay with this? Mm-hmm. But now, because it's...
Well, the thing is, obscenity is a sort of a three-part test, and a couple of the key phrases in the law are like prurient interest. Well, who the hell knows what that means in today's...
Yeah.
In 1957, that meant anything that like excited lustful thoughts or enticed lustful thoughts, which when you really got right down to it, made sense, where it's like, well, if you see this and you want to masturbate, this is bad. We don't feel that way as a society anymore. So, pornography isn't looked at that way in most metropolitan jurisdictions. So that has changed. And things like patently offensive, which is part of the second prong. What does that mean? It means beyond the level of candor in the community. But with pornography being ubiquitous, how could you be beyond the level of candor? And then the third prong, which is whether it lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, is just full of questions, as in literary to whom, or what does serious mean, or, pornography
is...
It's
so subjective.
Totally subjective. And the government knows that. And when they go after people, they try to get the most restrictive jurisdictions, and they try to put people that have never seen pornography on the jury, so that they'll be shocked and they won't listen to the judge when he gives them the instructions. They'll just say, I've seen this and it's terrible and I want to send that guy to jail.
So you're saying that when obscenity laws and technology and sexuality all commingle, mm-hmm. and a more conservative point of view wants to make things go away, they will make sure all of those Venn diagram in a jurisdiction like, what are some locations around
the
U.S.?
They used to go for Utah quite often. They used to go into, obviously, the Bible Belt. There was a recent trial, actually, in Arkansas right after ours, where they went after some relatively hardcore stuff, and the jury actually found the defendants not guilty. They actually went all the way to the jury. The Stagliano trial, we won. We never had to go to the jury. We tore the government's case up so badly that the judge granted our motion to dismiss the case at the end of the government's case in chief. So I have kind of what I like to call legal blue balls. I have all of these arguments all ready to go, and I never get a chance to make them because the government did such a horrible job. The best part of that, quite frankly, was after that, the Obscenity Prosecution Task Force, which was George Bush's sort of anti-porn group, was completely disbanded by the Obama administration. Huh. So that was great.
Yeah, that's using a lot of government funds and energy towards something that's...
Oh, yeah.
Not... Okay. We are... I totally feel that we are moving way faster than mm-hmm. what... I know there's... You have so much knowledge and you just...
I'm sorry.
No. Don't ever apologize for that.
I'm sorry I apologize.
Oh, okay. I forgive you. Okay. I want to just clearly there is a theme of obscenity and understanding obscenity laws. Mm-hmm. So you said lustful thoughts as the first prong.
Right.
And there is something around, and I've noticed this, and I have been thinking about what the emotion experience of a sexual arousal does to people, especially when sexual arousal triggers feelings of shame or guilt mm-hmm. in the person, and it can be very confusing. And most people can handle like a sexy HBO show or whatnot. Just don't watch it with your parents. awkward. But when it comes to things like pornography, watching humans have sex can be very arousing to make you want to have sex. And, yes. and it's so often that can cause a lot of discomfort.
Well, it can if you either don't know how to deal with those emotions, or if you feel shame about those emotions, or if you don't have an outlet for those emotions. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the anti-pornography folk out there constantly say is, you know, pornography leads to rape and, you know, all of that stuff. The best truthful statement about it I've ever heard was from a guy named Bill Margold. He was a porn performer mm-hmm. early on, and he started a group called Protecting Adult Welfare. His theory is pornography leads to masturbation, a ham sandwich, and a nap. what it's supposed to do is get you aroused. And if you're with a significant other, you play with your significant other. And if you're not, you play with yourself. Where people really lose their mind about pornography is when children get involved.
Right.
And obviously, I'm not talking about making pornography with children in it. That's illegal. It should be illegal. That's documenting yeah. the sexual abuse of minors. What I'm talking about is when a 16-year-old sees pornography and goes to mommy and says, "What did I just see?" And mommy is horribly uncomfortable about having to have the discussion. Mm-hmm. And so rather than getting over her own shame about sex, she turns around and blames the pornography company for mm-hmm. destroying her child. Mm-hmm. And what that does is two things. It displaces her own discomfort, but it also makes the kid feel like there's something wrong, and there isn't. The problem is their inability to communicate about sex.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, thinking about technology, I mean, we invented a camera, mm-hmm. and we like to take pictures of things, us at the zoo, and us with our friends, us having sex. Like, we like taking pictures of ourselves, and then the video camera came along. We like filming things, like telling stories, and stand-up comedy, and more sex.
I worked at a video store in the early 80s, and it would happen occasionally where we would, you know, sell video cameras. These were big, huge things that you could use at home, but they were really large and ungainly. And occasionally people would bring them back. You know, they'd buy them, and they're like, "Ah, that's really not what I want." And they'd inadvertently leave the tape in them. And there were more than one time, more than one time, where somebody would inadvertently leave a tape in their camera of them and their wife or them and their girlfriend or whatever fooling around. And many times it wasn't really people you wanted to see fooling around, but it was nevertheless funny.
Oh, did they come back for the videos?
No, they obviously forgot they were there, or they thought they'd erased them or something.
Right.
But it's funny. I mean, technology has largely been driven by people's desire to engage in, you know, sex in one way or another, either filming themselves or watching things in the privacy of their own home. And I think when you look at sort of the use of pornography in society, it was different when it was in movie theaters. I mean, mm-hmm. you're probably too young to remember, you know, the porno theaters on Sunset.
I remember I was a kid, but I remember yeah. being like, "Oh, look, that's where dirty things happen."
I grew up in the Valley, and on Lancashire Boulevard, there were a couple of movies. There was a Pussycat Theater, and, yeah. you know, I remember taking a girlfriend to the movie theater to see that, and it was full of, like, what we call raincoaters, old guys in raincoats,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know. I mean, that's largely gone now mm-hmm. because people don't want to watch sexual things like that.
It was an uncomfortable,
uncomfortable. and it actually, I think it led a lot to more of this sort of shaming thing that goes on with sex. The ability to watch stuff in the privacy of your own home is a completely different thing. It's rather freeing. Mm-hmm. And I think it makes people much more able to sort of experience stuff and go, "Well, you know, God, I didn't grow hair on my palms and I didn't go blind, so I guess it's okay."
Because it is okay. I'm not particularly pro or anti-porn. I'm really porn neutral. I do watch it sometimes, not as much as I'm sure my friends. But I do enjoy watching erotic films sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I know porn actors, and they're all very nice people, and very friendly, actually,
yep.
and lovely. But I know that lots of people are not around the sex industry in that way, and have these perceptions that people who are, I mean, part of the guilt is also, if I'm enjoying this, the people on camera are probably being sex trafficked or being forced into it. Now, there are some pretty bad actors.
Yeah, oh, yes, there are.
And there are definitely people who are doing it, going and working in that industry for reasons that are not probably that great for their own life journeys.
I think that's probably true.
But there's also lots of people who are very happy and sexual and talented and are excited about making money in a field that they're good at.
Absolutely. I can tell you, having been in the industry before I was an attorney and having now been around the industry for close to 25 years, I don't think I've ever met anybody who was actually trafficked. Mm-hmm. I have met some people, both men and women, that got into the business because of things that had happened in their life where they really thought they didn't have any place else to go, but it was still a choice they made. Mm-hmm. Whether it was positive or negative in their long-term life, I can't tell you. But 99% of the people that I've met that have been in movies, producing movies, performing in movies, are, for lack of a better term, normal, upstanding people, mm-hmm. Who have done this as a choice. They're exhibitionists, and they actually can't believe their good fortune that somebody would pay them mm-hmm. to do what they otherwise find enjoyable. There are always going to be, like in any industry, there are going to be producers that play the casting couch game. I think that's probably, at least in my experience, been worse in mainstream Hollywood than it has in pornography. You know, because in porn, when somebody walks in to test for a movie, you know, take your clothes off, turn around, you know, bend over. Okay, you look good. Come back next Thursday and we'll shoot you. But that happens in Hollywood all the time, and they don't really need to see him naked. And it's like, well, you know, if you really want the movie, I'm pointing at my groin.
He is doing that. Well, I mean, I figure in porn, it's like I am around sexual imagery a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I have a high tolerance for, I don't just get turned on constantly by things. I mean, because I'd be really distracted a lot. And so I can just only imagine if I worked in porn, I wouldn't be like just salivating over each person coming into audition. I'd be like, cool, you look great.
It's amazing how fast you go from like a sense of titillation to a sense of, you know, is it lunchtime yet?
Yeah.
I was actually a cameraman for a period of time and a porn editor.
Oh, yeah?
And if you really want to burn out on porn, edit porn. this is back in the days before we had nonlinear editing,
oh,
too.
No, so
everything
you were cutting,
was on. I was cutting tape.
Like literally cutting film.
Well, I never actually cut film. We would always do film to tape transfers, and then I would work on 3/4 or Betamax, or I'm sorry, Betacam tape. Mm-hmm. But sitting in an edit bay for 15 hours watching the same scene over and over and over, and you know, taking 3 frames out here and putting 2 frames in there and trying to get the director's instructions out of the background and getting the oohs and ahs to match, you get really tired of watching porn quickly. So right. Today when I watch stuff with my significant other or whatever, there's got to be something really unusual or special about it, or like intensely artistic, or there's mm-hmm. got to be a real genuine thing going on mm-hmm. for it to get my juices flowing. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of jaded.
Oh yeah, no, I hear you. But for the general population, there are stigmas around watching it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do not self-identify. And I'm sorry, but it is a billion dollar industry.
We did a white paper for Free Speech back in 97, I think, where they thought it was $11 billion.
What is a white paper?
The Free Speech Coalition is the trade association for the industry, and we would go on lobbying trips. And a white paper is sort of a political position paper that we would hand out to people. We would go up to Sacramento when they try to pass like porn taxes and things like that. Mm-hmm. And we'd literally walk around the Capitol and sit down with the legislators. And I, as an attorney, I would be like a lead for our team, but we'd always have a couple of porn stars and a couple of people that were, you know, somebody from a warehouse job or something like that, because you would want the legislator to know that if they're going to tax porn or make something illegal, it's going to cost thousands and thousands of jobs. It's going to mm-hmm. cost tax revenues. This is a major industry. The San Fernando Valley at one point was talking about seceding from Los Angeles County.
And there's so much money coming in.
There's a lot of money coming in, and the porn industry at the time was the largest industry in the San Fernando Valley, so it would have been a very interesting political landscape out there.
That would be very interesting. What was I thinking?
I'm sorry, you're talking about stigma and the such.
Oh, right. We talked with Dr. Marty Klein last week he had some really great stuff to say about like taxing strip clubs, because no one will get out and gather their neighbors together to be like, we need to fight this strip club tax. But the truth is if it is an $11 billion industry, it's okay. Like when I teach, let's say I teach a blowjob class mm-hmm. that's free at the Pleasure Chest, right? Which I do so every so often. And I'll tell people about it and they kind of I mean, like, oh, I've been talking to you for 5 minutes and you seem quite nice and outstanding as a human being, but who comes to these workshops? And they say it, and I'm like, people, and I say people just like you, couples and groups of mm-hmm. friends and really shy singles and like just the sweetest, nicest, curious people. And they kind of go, okay.
Because well, they need a validation that it's okay for them to want to go too. They want to feel like they're part of the group as opposed to somebody who's unusually weird that would be interested.
Exactly. And so it's interesting, for instance, like starting events here at Meltdown Comics, which is outside of the sex store landscape. But and people are a little bit more hesitant to just show up in a public place and be like, yeah, I'm a sex store. But the truth is when you show up, you go, oh, you're kind of cute and you guys are cool. And wait a minute, I saw you at the karaoke thing. And like, oh my God, this is just my community. So when you think about who's spending money at the $11 billion, if it were all creepers, a very small percentage of the population is actually creepy. Most
people, it's not 100 guys in raincoats by all of those movies, no.
And plenty of... It's just interesting.
Pornography is ubiquitous. And I'm not a psychologist. I have not studied, you know, cultural anthropology. I have friends that do that, and I rely on a lot of the things they tell me. But human beings like to watch other people have sex. There's just something innate about it, mm-hmm. and we like it. And probably because of religion and various other things, we're shamed to feel that that is bad. I think that the shaming causes more harm than the actual watching it. Because if another couple or moresome or whatever you want to call it wants to do it and you want to watch it and nobody is hurt, where is a government interest in regulating that? I don't see one.
So, and now when we talk about hurting. Now, okay, so we've been talking about obscenity. And I went off on the lustful thoughts thing, but I know there was three prongs. But you just brought up that little thing about no one's being hurt. Mm-hmm. Can we switch gears a little bit? Because I want to understand this condom law that has been kind of going around, which is, I haven't done a whole lot of digging. I'm not, my general focus in my sex education is around pleasure and relationships and dating and just people having really good personal communication skills. So when it comes to like porn law, I don't get as nerdy about that, you know, because I figure that's just a whole thing.
It's
right.
Okay.
So please help me understand. This is my general understanding. And I've talked to plenty of people who've come across me who work either as a camera person or mm-hmm. on camera in erotic videos. And they're frustrated because groups of legislatures who haven't even asked them what they thought about it.
Right.
There was a few, a much lower, porn actors have a much lower disease transfer between them than the general population.
It is significantly lower.
Like they have great testing, great standards.
Right.
They're very safe, actually.
You are much less likely to catch any sort of communicable disease having sex with five porn stars than you are going to a bar and picking up a random stranger.
You know, that's actually really interesting you said that, because Patty Kaysen, who's a local nurse practitioner, talked about how you can do the exact same behaviors with different population groups. Mm-hmm. And usually if they're a more affluent group, you're less likely because they have better medical and whatever. Same exact behaviors that you just tend to not get STDs mm-hmm. or STIs as much. So if I were to sleep with five porn stars, I would be much less likely to contract anything than if I slept with like five college students.
Absolutely.
So really we should be saying it's against the law not to have
sex without a condom.
Right.
Here's the real, there are a number of real problems with Measure B. And I'm, if anybody's listening, please vote no.
Measure B is
the AIDS Healthcare Foundation's attempt to enforce a condom ordinance, although it's actually more than that, on the adult entertainment industry for any films shot in Los Angeles County. Hmm. There are a lot of problems with it, and I could spend hours talking about it, but the long and the short is this. The testing mechanism that is used in the adult entertainment industry is very, very, very effective. The guy that is running the AIDS Healthcare Foundation actually was involved in suing the prior testing facility out of business. So when he says that he's trying to protect adult workers, I think that is incredibly suspect. My feel, and this is just my opinion, but mm-hmm. when I look at the way things are written, he is one of two things. He is either trying to sort of conscript the adult entertainment industry into making only safe sex videos, mm-hmm. which is unconstitutional on the grounds of what we call compelled speech under the First Amendment. Or he's actually trying to wipe the adult entertainment industry out altogether. And when you look at the way the law is actually written, it is more likely the latter rather than the former.
The law, I mean, B?
Measure B.
Measure
yes.
B.
Measure
on the November ballot.
On the November ballot.
Okay.
What it purports to do, what he tells everybody it's supposed to do, is require performers in the adult entertainment industry to only use condoms when they're having anal or vaginal sex.
Okay.
In fact, if you read the statute, it's much more draconian than that. It requires the companies to create these exposure systems. They have to do all sorts of record keeping. They have to get permits, which cost anywhere from $4,000 to $150,000, depending on how this whole thing flushes out. They then have to allow people on the sets to inspect. I mean, I'd love to be the porn inspector to make sure that everybody's using condoms. The next problem is that it requires more than condoms, because what it basically does is it takes another piece of California law, which was designed to protect workers in hospitals and medical testing facilities that deal with what we call the bloodborne pathogen rule. So if you're, and you know, somebody taking blood work at an AIDS clinic, or if you're, you know, doing HIV
like
work at a hospital,
vaccines,
exactly.
Sort of
if you're somebody like that, they want to make sure that you're not getting needle sticks and things like that. This statute is designed for that. So anytime, based on this protection mechanism that would be required, there might be, not even will be, but might be any sort of splatter. And we all know that good porn sets have a fair amount of splatter on them. You have to wear eye protection. You have to wear goggles. You have to use dental dams. You have to wear gloves.
So they're taking really wonderful laws that help protect people in hospitals around bodily fluids and applying them to
a pornography set.
Pornography set. But you're not – a patient that you're working with in a hospital may not have gone through tons of tests, whereas – the people on a porn set have gone through tons of testing before they arrive on set. So you're not dealing with the same general population as you would be in a hospital.
Correct.
Right?
And it's it's really – it's just insane.
Okay.
I'm sure that there's, you know, a perfectly good argument for the other side, but I'd love to sit down with Mr. Weinstein and debate it someday.
Okay. 'Cause I hate to think that anyone's got a like a devious reasoning around stuff.
Yeah, that's because you haven't been around all of this stuff as long as I have.
I'm joyfully naive sometimes.
I'll tell you a story about devious nature. And I can't go into the specifics of who this is, because I'm going to talk about a case that was decided quashing a grand jury subpoena. And for a quick sort of primer for your folk, grand jury testimony and grand jury proceedings are private. But many, many years – well, not many years ago, back in 2000 and I'm thinking 2008, 2009, a client of mine that has an adult entertainment company was hit with grand jury subpoenas out of the District of Columbia for their customer lists. They wanted all of their shipping records. And what they were saying was they were investigating whether they had shipped allegedly obscene materials into the District of Columbia. Now –
So legislature's in the D.C.
No, it's not legislature. This is the same Bush prosecution task force that went after Evil Angel. This was before they did Evil Angel. They went after this other company.
Client was located in California.
Client was in California.
And your client being a company that produces and distributes
adult entertainment.
Okay.
Yeah. Porn movies.
Okay. All right.
Hardcore, but porn. I mean, no kids, no animals, you know, typical stuff.
Just adults loving on adults.
Yeah. Consenting adults for consenting adults, which is where I kind of draw the line, by the way. I mean, people are always asking me, where do you draw the line? I don't want to see kids. I don't want to see animals, because animals can't consent. Mm-hmm. But anything between consenting adults for consenting adults is fine by me, whether I like it or not. I mean, it may not be something I want to watch, but that's the, anyway, so getting back to the story, what they were really trying to find was where they would want to prosecute this company, because they couldn't get them. They didn't want to hire 50 different cops in 50 different states and see if they'd ship the movies into the individual jurisdictions. Because they remember, you always want to try to prosecute somebody in the most restrictive jurisdiction. You're not going to prosecute somebody.
We're still talking obscenity laws. And obscenity laws, is that, does each, on the books of every city and every state in the United States, is there an obscenity law?
Actually,
is
no.
Is it written differently?
There are some states. Oregon, for example, doesn't have an obscenity law at all.
Huh.
I don't think Rhode Island does either. Hawaii has one, but it's been greatly restricted by their free speech clause, where anything between consenting adults is basically okay. But the federal the United States Supreme Court ruled in 1973 in Miller versus California. They created this obscenity test. And so all of the states in the union that still have obscenity laws are sort of bound by Miller. They may word them slightly differently, but they're all basically the same test. It's the three-part test. It's prurient interest, community so, standard stuff.
So there's a oh my God, what's that fancy word lawyers use? The Miller versus those guys. That's you call that the
precedent. I don't know.
Precedent.
Oh,
yes.
Good guess.
Thank you. Good work. So that's the precedent. And so if there's an obscenity law on the books, they have to comply with at least that
right.
thing in 1970.
Because under the concept of federalism and the applicability of constitutional law to the states, a state can give you more protection than the federal government does, but it can't give you less. So if the federal government defines obscenity, and here's kind of the irony of it, the federal government defined obscenity, the Supreme Court did, saying that this is how much we protect speech, but if you go beyond this, you can be prosecuted.
Okay.
So if you think about it, the obscenity laws were designed to prosecute pornography, and the Supreme Court says, well, you can only do it if you exceed this sort of imaginary gray line. Mm-hmm. And so if the states say, well, we'll let you do more, that's okay. But they can't say, we'll let you do less because you have a federal right to do it.
Okay.
Well, for those nice. Of you that missed civics.
At least there's that.
Yeah, well, it makes no sense anyway. The whole law is ridiculous.
Well, I kind of want to ask you, why is it ridiculous? Well, besides the subjective nature of it was incredibly frustrating.
That is the core reason why it's wrong. First off,
we need a new precedent.
We need to, well, it's funny. I mean, just in the last couple of years, the Supreme Court has dealt with other types of speech cases. They allowed the crazies that, you know, hold up the God hates fag stuff from the Southern Baptist Church or whoever they were to picket at funerals. And they said, well, that's okay. That's protected speech. And they allowed crush videos because, you know, torturing animals in movies, that's protected speech because it was overbroad and there was some vague language in it. But the obscenity doctrine has been on the law since 1957. And so in order to get the Supreme Court to reverse that, and that may happen someday, it's going to take the right case and the right set of facts, and it's going to be a difficult thing. I would love to be the guy to do it, by the way.
So violence against animals
is protected speech.
Is protected, but consenting adult sex is...
One of the things we like to say is you can show a movie of somebody cutting off a boob, but if you actually show the movie of somebody suckling on a boob, you can be prosecuted.
Right. I mean, I don't even get me into the breastfeeding thing.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating.
It's insane.
What is it about titillation, about people becoming aroused, that is so upsetting?
I have a one-word answer for you. Religion. Most... And I'm sure some people out there disagree with me, but I am... absolutely, positively confident in my bones that if you really took a close look at what's really going on here, this is the attempt at sort of the beginnings of a theocracy. Religion makes people do, you know, some wonderful things, and it makes people do some crazy things. And they're brought up thinking that sex is bad and sex is wrong, and anything that shows unmarried people having sex for fun is a sin. Mm-hmm. And we can't let that out there because if other people see it, they'll realize that all of this religious dogma around sex really doesn't make any sense. So it's sort of a control thing that comes largely from the church.
Mm-hmm. It's frustrating to me because, like, for instance, this podcast, I'm sure there's a group of people who really loathe this podcast because I'm not always constantly talking about two people who are a male and female in union with mm-hmm. the eyes of God. But still plenty of wonderfully religious, passionate people who are married listen and draw positive experiences from this show. And so, like, it's funny because, okay, I know separation of church and state, like, within what you can provide for the general population, since, you know, there are your people who are not so religious mm-hmm. in this country, you could have wonderful married people erotic videos for religious married people.
Right.
If they just left us to kind of create things, we could create better products that serve different groups of people.
Absolutely.
In a way that was honorable for them.
Sure. In fact, it's funny. The internet has really done that. The internet has allowed pornography to sort of specialize. Mm-hmm. It used to be, you know, in the 80s and 90s that people had to make movies for this sort of mass audience because everything was put out on tape and you had to sell a certain number of units to break even. But with the internet, you can do, you know, if you only have 500 customers but they're really, really loyal, you can do just fine. So if you want to make really pretty couples-only porn mm. for religious couples, and they only do it with the lights off in missionary position, if you can light it that way, there's a market for that, I'm sure. But the problem you have is that these – and I hesitate to sort of paint all religion with a negative brush. I don't want anybody to think that that's how I am getting across here. But it's really important that they understand that, as George Carlin used to say, you know, the radio has two knobs. One turns it on and off, and the other one changes the channel. If there's something out there that you find offensive or that your religion forbids you from partaking in – then don't watch it. Mm-hmm. But it's not up to you to, you know, goad your government into mm-hmm. making it illegal for everybody else, because we don't feel that way.
Yeah, it is strange to force everybody to comply to what makes you feel okay in living your life. It's mm-hmm. awkward. But of course, it's important for people to know that the people who are in this industry are also in it for positive reasons and
absolutely
are living. And I know Nina Hartley, I've known her for years, and she'll mention, like, oh, I was at dinner with my lawyer, and like, I've heard of this lawyer, and I realize
that would be me.
You. And so it's
one of those small world things.
Yeah.
Nina is in a lot of ways, Nina is the reason I'm actually a practicing attorney. Mm-hmm. I had not when I went to law school, it's kind of a long story, but the short end of it is I got arrested making porn and got mad. And rather than spend a bunch of money, you know, railing against the man, I decided I'd put myself through law school. And my plan was to be a pornographer with a law degree to keep myself out of trouble, but also mm-hmm. to understand the sort of intellectual property elements of it. Mm-hmm. When I got out of school, Nina had a problem, and I'd known her from being in the business. And it was an unusual case, and it involved intellectual property, her trademark, and her domain name, Nina.com. And there was a shoe company. There's apparently some big woman's shoe company called Nina Footwear. I mm-hmm. had never heard of them before, but apparently they're huge. And they wanted to take her domain away from her. So they asserted that she was infringing on their trademark. And I literally didn't know how to file a lawsuit yet. I had just gotten out of school. I just passed the bar.
Aww.
And Nina called me up freaking out. And I can't go into the specifics because there are confidentiality agreements involved. Mm-hmm. But we got a very good result.
Great.
Purely by A, luck, and B, by having a really, really good judge who knew that the little skinny lawyer at the table that basically didn't own a suit against, you know, the law firm with 400 lawyers really deserved to have his day in court.
Aww.
And he ruled, it was great. He told us to go out in the hall and work this thing out, and we did. And I didn't even know what I'd done. But she told everybody that I was a great lawyer, and so people started knocking on my door, and mm-hmm. the next thing I knew is I had a thriving practice. Mm-hmm. So as far as being a lawyer or a pornographer, it seemed that the lawyer was the better idea at the time.
No, I'm.
But no, she's the bomb. Nina is an educator before anything else. I mean, she's an incredibly sexy woman. She's sweet. She's smart. But her reason to be is to make people comfortable with sexuality and to make them think that there's nothing wrong if they're into this or that or the other thing, that there's lots of other people out there that share the same kinks and that it's all okay. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lid for every pot, you know.
Oh, I love that metaphor.
Yeah, she's a doll.
No, I
and her husband's great too, by the way.
Yeah, they're great. Taboo magazine. Yeah. I love what he created with that.
Yay, Ira.
He's like, I want to talk about Nina Hartley now because she's just so. Every time I see, because I'm constantly processing my own sexuality, I'm my career, my relationships, my evolution, and so every time I run into her, see her, we chat, and there's always something that I come away with it. And so she's been a wonderful mentor through the years.
Well, she's been very helpful for me in another way, since this is a sex nerd show. When we were doing these lobbying trips up to Sacramento, I had a young lady that I was dating who was going to law school, mm-hmm. and she came up with me to do this trip because she was going to be one of the lobbyists as well. And at one point, I had to go to some meeting someplace, and back at the hotel room, Nina was doing a blowjob training course, mm-hmm. and I came back just in time to find my lovely young lady learning to the names have been changed to protect the twisted, but she was learning her new. Favorite thing to do, and I was very, very pleased with the instruction. So I got an extra benefit out of that.
I love when I get like Facebook messages or texts from either a female who has come to one of my workshops saying that her partner, male partner, was just like freaking out and happy by what came of that mm-hmm. workshop, or I'll run into a male partner of a female that was at my and he'll just be like, thanks a lot, Sandra. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
It's great. I host a camp at a little gathering in the desert that you, I understand, have been to once or twice.
Ah, yes.
And we have a dome which allows for encounters of couples and moorsomes.
I have heard of this dome.
You have heard of this dome.
That's right.
And I've been a member of that camp for a lot of years, and one of the things that I really get a kick out of is people will show up and they're like, you know, we've never done anything like this before. Is it? Can we just sort of go in and look? And is it, you know? And you sort of gently get them involved, and they're like, well, we're just going to be in there for 5 minutes. Okay, yeah, it's fine, great, whatever. And you let them go in, and they come out an hour and a half later, and they're just spent, and they're so happy, like, that was great, thank you. You know, that's wonderful. And you know, I run into people in the lifestyle that we sort of roll down that hill from time to time, and it's really fun.
See, that of all the tips I can give people who ever want to enter a group sex space with people who are, you know, all very experienced in that area, because there's always the newbie who's like, is it okay if I just watch? Or mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to do anything quite yet. It's like, that is so common. Like, it's expected that you not do anything at first. You're supposed to just stand there and watch and absorb, and like, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, it's totally fine. And if you're in a situation in group sex where people are like pressuring you to do stuff, clearly you're in a bad place.
Right.
You're in the wrong group of people.
Sure.
Yeah. So, okay. I've been wanting to mention this for, because we talked about the condom laws and how it sounds nice, but actually is not helpful. And I know that lots of companies that make pornography are, it's best to trust them with creating those policies from within. Like, for instance, Wicked Pictures. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you work with them at all.
I know them very well, yeah.
But I just found out that they have, they integrate condom use into their movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the Wicked sampler at CatalystCon. And so I popped it in last night just to kind of check out what's going on. You know, I like to see what the different companies are doing. And sure enough, instead of the condom just sort of appearing, it's actually this very sexy scene. And they integrate, like, oh, get the condom. And they're like, oh, I can't wait to have sex with you moment. And the guy getting the condom on, or the female putting it on for him. And it's very sexy to see that, like, just that tension.
Sure.
So to see it done, and they're not doing it because anyone's making them do it, it's because that's part of their mission.
Of course.
And so I love that. And also they have this amazing line of videos now that's a little bit more softcore. Like, it's hardcore enough, but a little bit more soft.
Yeah, Jessica Drake and her husband Brad do a couple of lines for them. They do some instructional stuff as well.
Yes,
but
instructional stuff.
The thing is that when you talk about, you know, it's one thing. It's absolutely fine to say, I want to make a movie and I want to have my plot line involve condoms.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing if Mr. Weinstein owned a video store and he said, listen, I want to only promote safe sex material. So if your movie doesn't have condoms in it, I'm not going to sell your movie in my video store.
Mm-hmm.
That would be totally fine. What he can't do is say that the only way you can make a movie in California is if you want to use a condom. Because, I mean, I'll give you an example. A scene that I might want to shoot. I've got a couple. There's a plane crash. They're on a desert island. They're naked. They got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they develop a relationship over time, and now they want to have sex. Well, they don't have any condoms. How can you magically have a condom appear and have this thing make any sense? You know, and there are people out there to go, well, you know, you can just edit the condom out, or you can, you know, special effect the condom out. Well, it's not as easy as it sounds. Mm-hmm. The technology to do that isn't there. And to sit there and, you know, color frame each video image going for, you know, a 20-minute scene would cost tens of thousands of dollars. And based on the economies of scale of pornography today, that just wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically making it impossible to do a scene like that. It's not up to the government to tell the people that are making movies to any sort of expressive conduct what they can and what they can't do. That's up to the speaker, at least under our Constitution. The person that wants to put the message across is entitled to say what he wants to say. And the response to that is not censorship. Mm-hmm. The response to that is speech that disagrees. And that's how we get along as a country.
Right, because we have to have a certain amount of tolerance throughout different
points. Absolutely.
Now, okay, I really want to get into sexual expression.
Okay.
But I realized there is the part of me that thinks, well, what about the little guy or gal who wants to work in sexual film, and they only feel comfortable doing it if they use barriers, including condoms.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who are making or shooting or producing that porn doesn't want a condom in it, and so then they're having for their own safety, they want to use condoms, but the producer does not want them to have a condom scene. Where do you want them
Well, ideally,
they're out of a job then.
Ideally speaking, that's the kind of thing that comes up in the, quote, casting process. I mean, most of the people in the industry today have agents. Mm-hmm. There are a number of licensed and bonded agents that do nothing but deal in adult entertainment stuff.
I never thought about that. And of course
the
agent,
of course there are. And so the agents have the list of what each individual does. Do they, you know, do they only do girls? Do they do boy-girl? Do they do group stuff? Do they do interracial? Do they, you know, all of the various do's and don'ts that the people do, the lists of guys that they work with and the list of guys that they may not want to work with, and vice versa, by the way. It's the same thing for the guys. And so if somebody doesn't want to shoot unprotected, then that's just part of their rider. Either they get picked up or they don't. Now, you know, you can't really say, well, that's unfair if somebody doesn't want to shoot with condom or without condoms, that they should be able to make the producer allow them to do that. It's the producer or the director or the artist that's creating the work who is casting. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't want to do what the artist that's created the work wants you to do, then you don't do that job. You do a mm-hmm. different job. Believe me, there's plenty of stuff out there for people that only want to work with condoms. There just are. So that's just, that's really kind of a dead argument.
So that concept of, oh, protecting the little guy, in actuality, in the industry, there are plenty of moments where people just make their choices around what they're willing to do, and
absolutely.
You go from there. So you don't just show up on set and start crying.
No.
That's not how it works.
I'm sure that there have been those occasions where mm-hmm. some unscrupulous director, you know, has said, okay, you're going to do X, and you get on the set, and now they want you to do Y. Mm-hmm. And they sort of try to goad you into it by paying you more money or whatever. I only know in the 20 years I've been doing this of one situation where a young lady was sort of, I wouldn't say forced, but sort of coerced into mm-hmm. going beyond the level of comfort that she had. And had she been smart about it, she could have extricated herself. But that is an incredible rarity.
Okay.
99.99999% of the time that people go in, they know the guy they're going to work with. They know what they're going to do. They know what positions they like, and they know the director, and they know the cameraman. It's a small, for lack of a better term, incestuous industry.
Right.
And, you know, we all know each other. And, you know, certainly there are going to be new people that come in, and they may not feel quite as comfortable working with somebody the first time, and they might end up being great friends, or they might not. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's like any other business. So it self-regulates. And if somebody is forcing people to do stuff that they don't want to do, the industry will drum them out very, very quickly because they don't want that type of person out there as an example to be shown to the people that are anti-porn in general. Mm-hmm. They're always looking for people like that mm-hmm. To say, see, this is what the actual pornographer is like, and they're not.
And having worked in just mainstream TV and film, like that was a couple years of my life. I had a walkie-talkie, and I worked in television and film production. Very stressful time. Mm-hmm. And then I followed my passion.
Good for you.
But during that time, I worked with plenty of independent film companies or TV, like reality TV companies, in the hierarchy of just production companies. Like, we are making a movie. We are going to make TV. There are definitely the shady small companies where, you know, the producer is boning the makeup artist, and these guys are lying to those people, and, you know, someone's doing coke in the trailer mm-hmm. before they go on screen. And so it's kind of like in any industry, you have different companies doing similar things, and they're all going to have different levels of awesome.
Right.
And so in the porn industry, there's actually a hierarchy too. And when people think about porn, they probably think about like the lowest of the low in terms of what is actually happening. But there's a lot of actually really good, high quality, cool people.
There are. And quite frankly, when you talk about like drugs on a set and stuff like that, that almost never happens. I mean, I've been on hundreds of sets, and I can literally say I have never seen any drugs other than the occasional, you know, joint that comes out in the backyard when no one's shooting. Because nobody wants that stuff around. You can't really perform if you're high. People want that sort of natural, the connection. They want to see that connection on film. And the guys that make a living doing this don't want to mess that up. And they certainly don't want to put themselves at risk. I mean, you never know when...
Plus, it dries you out.
It dries you out, but you never know when a cop's going to knock on a door, mm-hmm. you know, and say, I want to see your permit. Mm-hmm. And if you've got your permit and everything's fine, they're going to leave. But if they find, you know, lines of blow on the table, things are going to go south real mm-hmm. fast. So that really, I think that Hollywood has a much greater incident of that sort of shady producer and mm-hmm. you know, the here, do another line, Tootski, or whatever the Saturday Night Live sketch was, you know.
I mean, I will say that the porn industry does
look in the porn business, you know, you're going to get screwed, but it's in a good way.
Well, there's a lot of really intense personalities. I mean, you can say that about a lot of industries.
Absolutely.
But there's a lot of, I mean, very gregarious, very open, very, sometimes loud, sometimes kind of intense. Or
sure.
There's a lot of interesting energies around.
I think that comes from the fact that they're working in at least what a lot of people used to think of as sort of a guerrilla industry. You've got to have a certain kind of mindset to put up with the stigma that a lot of people give you. And so if you're sort of a wallflower who really can't handle that kind of stuff, that's not the business for you.
Yeah, like if there were no stigma around it, I would, of course, have sexuality videos, instructional sexuality videos, where I was just having sex and like talking about it while I was doing it. Like,
I know somebody that would shoot those for you.
Yeah, and it makes so much sense. Like, I've thought, like, oh God, can I just do it and then show you by doing it? But then it gets really friggin' weird.
Yeah, I know.
And so I have a major line around that. I'm not going to do that. But why is it so weird?
I'll tell you a funny story. I have, in my earlier days in this industry, dated girls in the business. Obviously, I'm with my lovely Sarah now, and so we don't do that anymore. But
because you're so cute.
What she sees in me, I have no idea. But I was dating a girl, and we were walking around a mall. And what's very funny, and she pointed out that it would happen, and I didn't believe her, and then I watched it happen. People will be walking along, and they will see the porn star. And the first moment in their eye is, I know that person from somewhere. And then you see the light go on. It's like, oh, yeah, I jacked off. And then they realize they're standing there with their wife. Uh-huh. And in the next quarter of a second, it shuts off, and they pretend like they've never seen you ever. They don't know you. You're like invisible to them, right? So there's that weird stigma out there where people want to go up to you and say, hi, I like you, I enjoy your work, but they feel like they can't.
Right.
Now, if you walk around with that same exact person at a mall in Europe, people will come up to you and ask you for your autograph.
Oh, really?
Or, by the way, if you're Ron Jeremy, people will walk up to you all day long and ask you for your autograph.
Well, he's done a nice crossover into reality TV. Interesting. Yeah. Definitely, I wonder sometimes if I'm out and about and I see someone like staring at me and they're not coming up to me. I don't know if it's because they listen to the show.
No, you're just cute.
No, but it's a different. It's not like a glancing, eyeing, meeting dance. It's more like a. I don't know, but people constantly think I look like their cousin. So it's also, I probably
that
look like someone
it.
They know.
I mean, there's always that sort of I know you from somewhere kind of thing, and they can't figure out where. And when you work in an industry that has some sort of stigma attached to it, like lawyers, for example, they're like, I know that guy from somewhere, but they can't quite figure out where. And then it's like the light goes on. And if it's something that they think of as a positive, then they're all over you. And if they think of it as a negative, then they're just gone.
Interesting. So interesting. Anyway, I mean, it's a conversation for the ages.
I know you wanted to ask about sexual expression.
Oh,
so
I do. I want so. Okay, can I frame it? So last week we did have a mini interview with Dr. Marty Klein, and I loved what he talked about, where emotion fuels a lot of just a lot of how you talk to people in politics, and the right is doing a much better job of that at the left. But as he talked about this, he mentioned that to tax expression at a strip club and not tax expression at a ballet, that's a problem.
Should be unconstitutional.
Whereas, because Dave and I were talking after, and there is, because, you know, cigarettes and alcohol are taxed because they're, you know, naughty,
but see, there's no constitutional right to drink alcohol, or there's no constitutional right to smoke cigarettes. Those are just products that are sold, and they're governed by what we call the police powers, the government's general ability to regulate, you know, commerce and so forth. But when you talk about expressive conduct, you fall under the First Amendment. The easiest way I can always explain that is, you know, if I'm holding up my middle finger doing the, you know,
he
the,
is right
I'm flipping
now.
Off
He's
the
flipping
bird.
Us off. It, Katie,
when someone does that, I'm not actually speaking. I'm expressing something, and people know what I'm expressing. So speech is more than just speaking. Speech is also expressive conduct. So making a movie is speech, and printing a newspaper is speech, and putting on a play is speech. So if you, for example, and speech is protected by the First Amendment. And one of the classic ways of sort of distinguishing between the two are in the flag burning issues. Lots of, you know, conservatives are all up in arms about burning flags. And the whole thing is that if you're burning a flag to make a protest, like if I'm standing on the courthouse steps and I don't like a case that's just come down and I burn an American flag, people know I'm doing that to communicate a you know, dissatisfaction with something that my government has done.
Okay.
They can't prosecute me for that under a Supreme Court case called Texas versus Johnson. Mm-hmm. But if I find a flag laying on the ground and I go into a back alley and I'm cold and I want to burn that flag to make a fire so I can stay warm, mm-hmm. there's no expressive element in that. So mm-hmm. the government could prosecute me under a flag desecration statute for that activity. Mm-hmm. So the question is it expressive?
So when you say speech, okay, because the idea of like, well, stripping is expression. That sounds very woo-woo. And it's kind of like, well, it's an art form. It's like, it doesn't feel quite right to me. Like, it sounds a little woo-woo. So to be a little more clear, speech as communication, communicating or trying to create an experience in another person that
it's trying to communicate an idea that the other person is going to receive or okay. should be able to receive. Now, you know, ballet makes people swoon or makes people cry or it gives them some sort of emotional, you know, content. Stripping, if it's done right, you know, at least from a guy's perspective, can do exactly the same thing. Now, it may not be the message that some people are happy with them communicating, mm-hmm. but it certainly does. And, you know, the unfortunate reality is that when you say, well, we're going to tax strip clubs, but we're not going to tax the ballet, that is a restriction.
It's a value judgment on different behaviors.
Right. It's a restriction on one form of speech that isn't there for a different kind of speech. And the government isn't supposed to be able to play favorites.
Okay. That's a little bit easy. Okay, because I was thinking, just in working it out in my head, that, well, when it comes to the body's behaviors, like just moving, or if I suddenly start dancing ballet, and mm-hmm. I'm behaving in a certain way, or if I start taking off my clothes, I'm behaving in a certain way. But taking off my clothes on a street corner just because I feel like behaving that way.
That's an entirely different thing. We have laws in this country. Most states have some sort of lewd conduct law, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the guy walking down the divider in the freeway, you know, swinging Willie around just for the sake of doing it. He's not trying to communicate anything. He's just out there being lewd. Mm-hmm. And that can be prosecuted. I mean, if you
define lewd.
Well, lewd is something that entices lustful thoughts.
Ooh, well, now we're getting into obscenity laws.
But, yeah.
But stripping is technically lewd then.
Yes.
Okay.
But stripping is done specifically as communicative activity. So there's a difference between lewd conduct and obscenity. And this is where the interesting line is drawn. I have a case that I dealt with in the late 90s where three girls that worked for Seymour Butts were at the Erotica LA show doing a simulated lesbian scene live. Mm-hmm. And they weren't doing anything. I mean, I was there. I watched it.
Do you mean there was no penetration?
There was no penetration. They had their clothes on, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. They were playing with each other. I mean, it was, you know, Erotica LA is...
Playing, you mean like touching their arms and kissing?
Yeah. I mean, they were like sort of pretending to go down on each other, but they weren't really doing it.
Okay.
And they got arrested. And they charged them originally with lewd conduct.
Okay.
And, you know, people were standing around and taking pictures. And it was clearly designed to draw people into the booth. And mm-hmm. they were trying to communicate a message, which is, hey, we're sexy, come buy our movies. Mm-hmm. So I filed a motion with the state in the state court that said you can't charge them with lewd conduct if it's not obscene, because it would have to be beyond, it has to violate the obscenity statute for them to prosecute speech. Mm-hmm. You have to let them go. And rather than
I don't quite follow the reasoning. You can't prosecute them for lewd conduct because it's not obscene.
No, you can't prosecute them for lewd conduct because it's a matter of expression. They're actually engaging in a show. They're putting on a show.
So because it's on a stage and it's like, here, we are about to have a show. Like, it's
actually,
very official.
Strangely enough, there's a Supreme Court case that says it doesn't even have to be a stage. Mm-hmm. The issue is, what is the intent of the performer? Mm-hmm. And if the performer's intent is actually putting on a show, and the possibility is that the audience is going to watch it and get the message somehow, now mm-hmm. it's expressive conduct. Now, if it falls under the First Amendment, lewd conduct laws don't satisfy the protection that you get from Miller, because it doesn't have to be patently offensive and it doesn't have to appeal to a prurient interest. It can just be lewd. So the Constitution says, you can't prosecute us for that. They'd have to charge him with obscene live conduct, which is what the state did, and then they lost. And
I'm lost.
I'm sorry. I talk too fast about this kind of stuff.
No, it's okay. I like intellectual challenges like this because it's also kind of like a brain thing. Sorry, I'm also like preparing to go to grad school, and so I'm starting to study for the GRE and kind of
your
just
brain is
figuring
full.
Out. No. It's that I like these sorts of brain teasers. Like, oh, I just want to understand. But right now, I've got a trinity where there's obscenity things with the, you know, lustful thoughts and beyond candor or something.
Think about it this way. The obscenity test has three parts. If it's an expressive act and it doesn't satisfy all three of the elements of obscenity, it's protected speech and the government can't prosecute you for it. If it's not an expressive act, they can prosecute you for lewd conduct, even though the lewd conduct laws don't satisfy all three prongs of the Miller test.
So I guess, just so I can... Lewd conduct. Okay, dude swinging his penis around, mm-hmm. walking down the street.
Mm-hmm.
Lewd.
Lewd.
Dude on a stage, or not on a stage, but for the intent of people. Because either way, dude...
Penis puppetry.
Right,
remember
penis
that?
Do I ever. I really liked the sailboat.
Okay.
And the turtle. But you do it on stage, and it's... Or for the intent of a show...
Mm-hmm. So now it's expressive conduct, and the only way you can punish that is if it's one of the elements of unprotected speech, like defamation or obscenity or fighting words or things like that. There are certain kinds of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment.
I have a sense that the element of public versus private space mm-hmm. is important to this, like walking down the street.
It's part of it, because you can't be prosecuted for lewd conduct in a private space. I mean, they can't come into your house if you're walking around naked and charge you with lewd conduct unless your windows are up and you're, like, showing off to the neighbor's
kids.
Right,
like you need permits to have a strip club in a certain part of town and whatnot. But still, that is a privately owned building and space.
Right.
So that's part of it, but not all of it. So I'm still trying to differentiate between if I want to take my clothes off on a stage at a strip club versus on the street corner.
Mm-hmm.
But then what if it's a political protest and I'm doing it
and because there have been cases of lewd conduct charged that were dismissed by judges because that was actually a political protest. There was one down here in, I think it was at the Santa Monica Pier within the last couple of years, where a bunch of women walked around topless trying mm-hmm. to protest the fact that guys could go to the beach with their shirts off and women couldn't.
This.
And the women were all arrested for lewd conduct. And the judge threw the prosecutions out saying, no, under these circumstances, this is core political speech.
So funny. Boobs are really great. I love breasts. I really do.
I don't disagree with you.
It's funny that because we love them so much, we hide them. You know,
if you spend any time in Europe or any of the I call the more evolved societies, you know, it's amazing how they just don't get all worked up about the sex thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're better adjusted. The incidence of rape are lower. The incidence of sexual violence are lower.
There's less repression going on.
Yeah, right? It's all good, you know, and people, you know, prostitution is legal and regulated, so you don't have the slave trade kind of problem. All of these things are so much easier when we get over the original puritanical hangups. Mm-hmm. Hopefully this will happen here. I don't know.
Religion? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like you said, the whole, laws are 10 to 15 years behind technology, and sometimes often even more so behind just cultural evolution. And I feel like religion can often be that way in terms of not quite being at the forefront of, like, catching up with what people want and need. And
in fact, I think religion is exactly the opposite. Most of the developed organized religions are all about holding dear to their dogma, and they don't change with regards to, you know, changes in time. And you see that now with the gay rights stuff. I think that is the sort of civil rights matter of our day.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly hope that this term the Supreme Court takes a gay rights case.
Mm-hmm.
They could take the one out of California and do a very limited ruling, or they could take one out of the East and do a more expansive ruling. And I am guardedly optimistic that Justice Kennedy, who would be the fifth vote currently on the court, will go for legalizing gay marriage. And I do that because the two really important First Amendment cases, or gay rights cases, that have been done, Cathcart and Lawrence, were both written by Justice Kennedy. So Lawrence versus Texas is an amazing... If any of your readers want to read a really important case, read Lawrence versus Texas. The language in it is beautiful. It legalized sodomy. So there was a nice benefit on the side. But it was in 1986, a case called Bowers versus Hardwick, no relation, ruled that the states could criminalize sodomy between gay people. And sodomy was more than just penis-vagina sex. I mean, it was anything other than penis-vagina sex. So even in states in Nevada, which was largely Mormon, you could go there and get a blowjob from your honey and you're breaking the law.
We can't even... Okay, we haven't even... We're running out of time.
I'm sorry.
But no, it's okay. We've talked about lots of wonderful things, and this is a very heady but fun conversation.
Cool.
You know, it's exciting because it's so hard to understand. So it's important to have people like you who have a good grasp on these things.
You know,
it's very important work you're doing. But just the idea that in the privacy of my own home, there are laws regulating how I can touch myself or a partner.
There are still states in this union that have vibrator laws, like what they call obscene devices laws, where you can't use a vibrator.
And I highly resent keeping people from accessing, well, contraception and birth
Absolutely.
Control in wherever they are,
mm-hmm.
but also just something that has a motor that is off balance so that it makes the plastic parts move.
It doesn't
in a
even
way
have to be a vibrator
be.
Vibrator. It can be like just a dildo. They're, you know, obscene devices or anything designed to stimulate the human genitals.
Right, so cucumbers should be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, those weren't designed for that. But, you know, a rubber dick is mm-hmm. illegal in some states.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. So, I mean, that I have huge problems about.
I agree with you.
Because I know that the attitudes are that these are bad things, and there's just a lack of perception, positive perception about it. But knowing how much these can just help couples mm-hmm. and help and enrich lives.
Well, the really funny thing about the states that have those laws is generally the state right next door don't. And so what you have are all these little video stores that pop up just on the other side of
right.
the border where they just do a bang up business. And strangely enough, an interesting fact, the state that per capita has the largest use of online pornography mm-hmm. would be Utah.
Ooh.
Where there is almost no, you know, adult entertainment available like at local stores and things like
that. Right, because that's where it's being channeled.
That's where it's going.
Jeez. I mean, cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad they have access somehow. Because if someone wants this and it's not doing harm, what the
consenting heck? Adults for consenting adults, you know?
It's a constant brain teaser. And Alan, I just really appreciate you coming on today and talking
Pleasure's
with
mine.
Me about this. And thank you for your birthday gift. You
Aww.
Totally gave me an awesome giant bottle of Grey Goose,
which
I appreciate.
The whole theme was get me drunk, so I figured it was the least I could do.
Yeah, Dave and I, our birthdays are 2 days apart. Thank you for all the happy birthday wishes, P.S. Dave appreciates it as well, even though he's not here. So thank you. But, you know, what did you say? What was your card? It was hilarious.
Oh, about putting, when you get older, you put things in the wrong places and then you open it up and it says, yeah, that can really help your sex life.
Right.
Yeah.
It gets very entertaining
yeah.
when you start putting things in the wrong place. Use lube. Oh, God. Wait, there's something. I can't even remember what I wanted to say. But basically, thank you again. Write me the stories of how this podcast has affected your life. I've been loving those. The subject line, story. October 11th, out at Meltdown at 9 p.m. on October 11th, but also up at UCSB if you're around campus. 11 a.m. Oral sex, 1:30 p.m. sex toys. And Alan, how can people find out more about you, your work? Do you have a website? Do you want to do a book?
You can send me an email at xxxesq@aol.com.
Okay.
Or you can reach me through Sandra. I'll make sure she's got some ways to get a hold of me. I'm relatively easy to find.
Okay. Do you have a Twitter account or Facebook?
I'm on Facebook.
Okay.
And it's just my name, so Alan Gilbard. I'm a little bit of a Luddite when it comes to using all of the social media.
No, it's okay. I mean, you're really wonderfully entrenched in a very specific part of our legal system.
Thank you. You're
a resource. So at least people have your email address in case.
The biggest thing I can tell you is if you have any interest in getting involved in the adult entertainment industry, please make sure you talk to a lawyer that knows this stuff first, because there are a lot of pitfalls that people can fall into. There's a group called the First Amendment Lawyers Association, plug.
Okay.
All around the country that we have guys that do what I do and defend adult companies and know how to set companies up legally and so forth. So talk to somebody before you do it.
All right. Well, naughty monkeys, once again.
Couldn't resist.
Oh, man. Go Team Fun. Thanks for listening.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.